Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. The story coming out of the Virginia executive branch is turning out to be a real thriller, isn't it? And before Ralph Northam moonwalks out of our life, and he's, by the way, he's not ready to do that yet because he's not willing to be known as a racist for life by resigning.
That's his whole point of contention. I don't want to know that I'm a racist. I can't be remembered as that. But it's kind of falling apart because first there was a denial. Or first there was an apology, then there was a denial. Now there's this resistance of what he's going to do.
Well, and the successor waiting in the wings, Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax, has his own problem, it turns out. Boy, I mean, this whole story, you have to overlay the Brett Kavanaugh saga.
Yeah.
So before you get too sympathetic in the direction of Northam and Fairfax, just remember how Brett Kavanaugh was treated. The Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax yesterday reaccused by a woman who is now a professor at Scripps College of sexual assault 15 years ago at the 2004 DNC when Mr. Fairfax was a staffer for John Kerry. Vanessa Tyson is her name. It's been disclosed. And her friend was given permission to release this statement that Vanessa Tyson made to her, in which she said, "Imagine you were sexually assaulted during the DNC convention in Boston in 2004 by a campaign staffer. You spend the next 13 years trying to forget it ever happened until one day you find he's the Democrat candidate for statewide office in a state some 3,000 miles away, and he wins that election in November 2017. Then, by strange, horrible luck, it seems increasingly likely that he'll get a very big promotion." Well,
he's saying it was consensual, Dan.
Oh, I know what he's saying. I know what he's saying. Also,
this has already been, you know, litigated.
Yeah,
court of public opinion. No charges were ever filed.
Yeah, Fairfax is also leaning on the fact that this was circulating during one or more of his runs for public office, and the press, the D.C. press corps, declined to report it. Well, the D.C. press corps and their standard when it comes to fellow travelers versus, say, conservatives, that's a whole other topic. But here's Justin Fairfax in front of the press gaggle responding to Ms. Tyson's allegation.
So I met her at the convention. We met and talked, and I did not know her prior to. I was 25 years old, unmarried, a campaign staffer at the time, and we hit it off. She was very interested in me, and so eventually at one point we ended up going to my hotel room. This is in 2004. She was, very much into, consensual encounter. And she even admits in the story there's a consensual activity going on. And again, I have children, so I'm going to be very circumspect about what I say. But everything was 100% consensual. And not only that, the same person called me sometime later and wanted to meet with me, wanted to come visit me. I was still in law school, at Columbia Law School, wanted to come in New York City to meet with me, wanted me to meet her mother. And said that years later, months later in this case, and years later now, we have a totally fabricated story out of the blue that's meant to attack me because of where I am in politics. The fact that it only came up once I won. And remember, I have run for office before. I ran in 2013 in a primary statewide. I ran in 2017 in a primary statewide. I ran, of course, in the general and won. It was only at the point that I won that this person fabricates this claim and then attempts to, again, get it into the media. And when they fail the first time to get it into the media, comes back around a year later at another point of maximum media attention.
Yeah, so I understand the standard, going back to my experience covering the Kavanaugh confirmation hearing. if a woman makes an allegation, she's to be believed.
Right.
So
plain and simple.
So how do we handle the situation with Lieutenant Governor Fairfax? Would be Governor Fairfax.
312-642-5600 is our turnkey.pro answer line. 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. Well, you know, the fact that she wanted to visit him, she wanted him to meet her mom. I'd love to see if that's true. Did she really do that, or is he just saying that now because it's convenient?
Well, wait a second.
Or was this consensual? I mean, he was 25, Dan. He was single.
Are we allowed to ask those questions about her, about evidence, about facts? We have a statement from Miss Tyson, just as we had a statement from Miss Blase Ford. And that's it. The discussion is over. We have the statement. The idea that the man is allowed to respond, that the woman should undergo any questioning to substantiate, to provide answers that may or may not tend to substantiate her claim, isn't that out of bounds? I'm just trying to understand what the standard is here. Where were Northam and Fairfax during the Kavanaugh hearing?
Just probably praying they weren't next.
Just part of the mob. Ed in Oak Brook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
You know what? Believe it or not, I really don't care what happened to this girl or this guy that happened, I don't know, 15 years ago. My concern is the actual people or the women, even men, I guess, today, that are being raped and violated and assaulted for real. When they get off the L, you hear these stories all of the time, people being, people working late, and then they come home, and then they're assaulted and beaten up. Those are the people I care about. This girl goes to a convention. What do you think goes on at these conventions? They're all talking about nuclear treaties and stuff. It's one big sex pit. Everyone knows that. So, wow. You know what? I really don't care, Democrat okay. or Republican.
Okay, Ed, thanks for Everybody. The call and that insight. I've been to a number of Republican conventions, and that has not been my experience, but
no,
okay.
But they are, you know, time to hook up with old friends. Not hook up, but reconnect. God, whatever I say sounds good.
Yeah, okay.
Trying to get together with old friends
sure.
at a bar.
Yeah.
I went to the RNC, and I didn't even go to one bar because of my broken foot. Boo, hoo, hoo.
It's a terrible story.
And I didn't meet anybody except Milo.
Well, wait a second, though.
They're fun. But they're parties. DNC, it's a blast.
Well, that's fine. But you have a woman making an accusation of criminal conduct.
I know, but I want to know more details. I want to know exactly.
Well,
what
I'm just
she's
going.
Alleging.
I'm just good.
Because he's saying it was consensual. So
I'm just going to Ed's point about. Well, I don't care what happened. I care about real victims. Well, you don't know that Ms. Tyson wasn't a real victim. I don't either. But it's just a reminder that. If we're going to ask questions in this context, then it's legitimate to ask questions in every context. It doesn't matter the race of the alleged assailant or the alleged victim. It doesn't matter the political persuasion. It matters the evidence. And we should have a healthy skepticism with respect to these incidents that are difficult to prove, where there are allegations are I won't say easy to make, but they're easy to make without evidence and, you know, have the train leave the station. And it's very hard to return the train to the station when you're talking about sort of reputation if the allegation is false or if the allegation has been sensationalized. We went through this with Keith Ellison. And here on this show, we exercised the restraint with respect to Ellison, who I find repugnant politically, that no one on the left exercised with respect to Kavanaugh, virtually no one. No one that I can think of offhand. No one of prominence. So for all of your hate has no home here, friends, who are just monstrous hypocrites, another teachable moment.
Stomach-churning hypocrites.
Should, you know, it's conservatives like us who will restrain ourselves with making determinations based on somebody's political persuasion or race when it comes to an allegation as serious as effectively rape or certainly sexual assault. That's what we're doing in the Fairfax case because we don't know.
Well,
that's the opposite of what was done with Kavanaugh.
Here's my position on that because I know a lot of girls who have been raped and the ones that have been raped, they immediately go to the police. There's no questions asked. They just do it. Again, this woman, Ms. Tyson, never filed a police report. Never filed a complaint, never did anything.
But there are cases where
I'm sure
people
no, I
don't,
know people that
and there
don't
are cases, and particularly you want it to go away, or it's a person of prominence, and you don't want to take on this public fight, or you don't want to be outed publicly. I get all of those situations. This is why you exercise restraint, so you understand the specific facts and the specific people that are attendant to those facts, rather than break out the torches and pitchforks, which is what the left did with Kavanaugh, and what they didn't do and haven't done and won't do with respect to any man on the left until it becomes so noxious that they're prompted to act, like Harvey Weinstein, the human stain, who Hollywood and Hollywood's elite and the left covered for decades until it became too noxious because of Ronan Farrow's reporting.
Yeah, and Ronan Farrow's reporting, that took almost a year to get out because publication after publication, NBC, they wouldn't run his story.
And you know what the interesting thing is? You know what the remedy for all of this is? Since we're mainly talking, especially the high profile, the men of the left who think being a man of the left gives them a license to behave like a barbarian, being a Christian gentleman. The one thing that won't be embraced, being taught to be a Christian gentleman, that's the one thing that will not be embraced. That is rejected out of hand. And you know what? It's the surest way to clean up all this Me Too business. Paul in Rockford. Hey, Paul.
Paul, speak.
Paul in Rockford, looking for Alyssa Milano. Yes.
Yeah, I was wondering, where's Alyssa Milano while this is going on?
She's huddling with DiFi. Thanks for the call, Paul.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy talking about Justin Fairfax, too. Another interesting thing the lieutenant governor of Virginia, the governor in waiting, did was sort of to insinuate that the story of the woman accusing him of sexual assault was being fomented by his political opponents or competitors, as it were. Listen to Fairfax.
There's a possibility that I might be elevated to the governorship. It's at that point that they come out with the attacks and the smears. It is unfortunate. It really is, but it's sadly a part of our politics now. So I met her at the convention. We met and talked, and I did not know her prior to. I was 25 years old, unmarried, a campaign staffer at the time, and we hit it off. She was very interested in me, and so eventually at one point we ended up going to my hotel room. This is in 2004. She was, very much into consensual encounter.
And that wasn't it. So anyway, he insinuated earlier in the day that Northam could be behind it.
Right.
And then he insinuated that Richmond Mayor LeVar Stoney, who may also be interested in running for governor, was behind it. So I just note that because it's sort of, unless he wants to present evidence, it's the act of a scoundrel. The one hand, you're saying we should not believe uncorroborated accusations against you. And in the same breath, you're making uncorroborated accusations about others.
And then this morning, CBS was reporting that the same news organization that leaked those yearbook photos also are responsible for leaking this information again about the lieutenant.
Well, it wasn't leaking.
But it's not like we didn't know because he's already
gone through this. Ms. Tyson, the accuser, gave her friend the green light to make that her statement public. So there was no leak. There was a distribution.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, worst Liam Neeson screenplay ever. Liam Neeson giving this interview with The Independent about an incident in which a family member of his was raped.
Bye.
And how he responded to it and why he's so ashamed.
Well, yeah, because they were interviewing him for his upcoming movie. And, he's always the tough guys, always, the hero.
I will find you and I will kill you.
Yeah, what was that from Taken 7?
Taken 9, actually. Yeah. But so, yeah, so they sat down for an interview, and he talked about this incident.
I'll tell you a story. This is true. I asked, did she know who it was? No. What color were they? She said it was a black person.
So what he did then was carry around a stick with him for about a week, he said, looking for this black man, but he used a different description.
I did it for maybe a week, hoping some black bastard would come out of a pub and have a go at me about something, you know, so that I could kill him.
He's from Northern Ireland, you know. He's taking it to the street. He's a vigilante.
It was horrible, horrible when I think back, but I did that.
So, he talked about it, and then he said it was horrible that he was racially profiling, maybe. He didn't say racially profiling, but he said it was horrible that I did that, that I could have, essentially been a better man. But now everybody's hair is on fire, and we're going to just take Liam away from every movie he's ever made. Are we going to Kevin Spacey him, act like he's never existed?
Well, Kevin Spacey is a little bit different matter. Sexually assaulting boys is a little bit different than the story Liam Neeson told. Do you find that story plausible?
Yeah. I do. Yeah. You don't? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
I don't know. I just wonder if Liam Neeson is having trouble separating his characters from reality these days.
Yeah.
Maybe one too many
Takens?
Commuter. Maybe one too many.
Well, his new one, he's in a snowplow, and it's up in the Antarctica. That's the scene.
Yeah.
And he's driving a snowplow to get to the bad guy.
Yeah.
He's the ultimate vigilante.
Planes, trains, snowplows. I get it.
He might not know how to separate his own persona from his characters. I get that. But was it how he described it? I mean, he was upset that a woman in his life, a family member, was raped, and he wanted justice. Yeah, he wanted street justice.
Keegan Jin. Yeah, I know. Yeah.
It's like Susana Mendoza, man. Justice.
Why offer up this story? This is with some sort of cathartic apology. I never admitted that, and I'm saying it to a journalist, God forbid. Okay. So what happened? Was the person who assaulted, raped your family member? He said raped your family member. Was that person ever identified and brought to justice? Did the interviewer ask that? Does anybody care? Or is this just about some sort of tortured story about an accusation against a black man, so he goes looking for a black man? And then after a week, he realizes, well, I can't just look for a random black man. It has to be the actual alleged assailant. I mean, this is ridiculous, this story. I just don't buy any of it.
A spokesperson for the NAACP says it's unfortunate and sick that Liam Neeson would, in response to a tragedy, simply seek out any black person to murder. Pain suffered is not an excuse for racism.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's such a thank you for that fifth grade, schoolhouse rock message. We appreciate it.
Thanks, NAACP.
This is idiocy. This is what it's come to? Bizarre stories with sort of no questioning of those stories. No sort of following up, asking for details. Fill in the blanks for us. What happened exactly, and you did what, and what was the ultimate resolution, and what happened with your family member who was raped? If you're telling a story like that, that's what he offered is the beginning of it.
Well, he said that he talked about this as a parable to the pointlessness of seeking revenge and connected it back to the conflict in Northern Ireland.
Can I get what you mean between the Protestants and
which
Catholics?
Which ended in 1998, which officially ended in 1998. Yeah.
What? What the hell is he talking
about?
He's talking
about the need for revenge, but it just leads to more revenge, to more killing.
Yeah,
more killing.
Right.
So
thank you.
He can't separate
I got
himself.
I get that plot line.
Can't separate. He can't do it, Dan. He can't do it.
I will find you, and I will kill you.
Well, isn't that so that's the good news, is the Taken series will be done now if Liam Neeson can't even promote the idea of an eye for an eye, which is what virtually every one of his movies is about. It's certainly the last
half dozen. He can't do anything else. Besides, he did appear in Ted 2, though, didn't he? But he was still in character.
Yeah.
When he was buying cereal at the
I mean, he's pretty, you know, he's pretty good. Like, Gray was good. And obviously Schindler's List, he was great.
Oh,
great movie.
Was, yeah.
But,
is he a racist? But
is he a racist? Is he lucid? Should he be walking the streets by himself? He is 66.
So that's the time to put
Well,
him
I don't know.
The
is he fading? I don't understand what he's talking about. And the context of the strife in Northern Ireland? What? I have this is not exactly biblical, what Liam Neeson offered. And what is he doing?
Well, sure. All right, so she said everything changed, and he brought the microphone, the recorder, closer to him. And she said that everything changed in the interview when she asked him why his character in the film embarks on a series of revenge killings after his son dies. And that's when he shared this story of how he wanted to beat up somebody who happened to be black, who raped a family member.
Why does your character engage in a series of revenge killings after your son is killed? That's a great question. God, it's such a unique plot.
Well, I've never heard it before. I mean, Taken 9.
This is so stupid. I mean, Hollywood.
Well, what do you want to see happen to him? Because I want this to just go away. I don't want them to do to him what they did to
happen to him?
Yeah.
For what?
They might not release the film.
Says who?
Well, they're worried. I mean, his co-hosts, Laura Dern and Tom Bateman, they are not responding. The company Lionsgate, which is distributing the new film, is not responding. I think they want this to just go away.
So do I.
I have a very particular set of skills. Skills I have acquired over a very long career. Skills that make me a nightmare for people like you.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy, so the dumbest man in television strikes again.
Excuse me.
Don Lemon interviewing, what, Gladys Knight?
Yeah, and he took her to task, you know, how could you perform the national anthem? Because, you know, a lot of the A-star singers and performers sat this one out in solidarity with Colin Kaepernick.
And nobody noticed.
And nobody knows, yeah, because it's over, okay, Don, it's over. But he took Gladys Knight, I mean, this beautiful woman who performed a beautiful song, and she's from Georgia, that's why she was chosen to sing. And he ripped on her, and she fought back.
People are going to have their opinions, you know, about whatever. And all I can deal with right now is what my heart says, okay? I believe in fairness. I believe in truth. I believe in all of those things. And as far as this is concerned, I grew up with the national anthem. We used to sing it in school before school started. We used to say prayers in school before school started. And we just don't have that anymore. And I'm just hoping that it will be about our country and how we treat each other and being the great country that we are.
So then he pointed out how a New York Times article wrote about a singer at President Donald Trump's inauguration who lost her career for taking that gig and suggested that she might lose her career for singing the national anthem.
At 74.
Yeah.
One of the queens of soul and Motown.
Really, Don?
You know what? Nothing good comes easy. And I would hope that they will understand, as I do, that we have a better way to do this than to be all angry and why is he doing this or why ain't she doing that, you know. It's just for me about respect for the, I mean, if we just start denying the anthem, there's so many people that have died for our country.
Yep.
And there's so many people in my family that are still part of you know, just standing for the country. They're in the services and that kind of thing. And just to not say that, if you really listen to the lyric of the beginning, mm-hmm. you'll understand that we have fought hard for a long time, and not just in wars.
Gladys Knight is a class act, and Don Lemon is a horse's ass.
I mean, for, how can he even ask
it's easy.
To come on the show and question.
That's great. I think it's great.
Threaten
because,
her career?
Oh, threaten
please.
Her. I think it's great because Gladys Knight shows who she is, and Don Lemon and CNN show who they are. It adds a lot of clarity. So good for Gladys Knight for going on and entertaining the children there over at CNN. Also, this was sort of overlooked.
What?
The Super Bowl MVP that you were gushing over yesterday.
Oh, can I play the song?
You shouldn't even have played.
Why? Wait, Edelman? Yeah. Why?
He went from PED to MVP.
PED?
Performance enhancing drugs. He was suspended for the first four games of the season for violating the NFL's substance policy.
Why? I didn't know that.
Yeah. So now maybe you'll tone down the...
Should they take back the 10 passes and the 141 yards?
Yes.
He accomplished?
And they should take back the Patriots' 2015 Super Bowl title for Tom Brady cheating with the deflated balls, as our friend 10-year-old Ace Davis proved. So the Patriots, all they do is just cheats. They cheat their way to titles.
Well, speaking of the Super Bowl, I want you to know that lowest ratings in 10 years. And you know why there were the lowest ratings in 10 years?
Because it was
besides the fact that it was boring. The viewership dropped 5.5% from last year, but in the city of New Orleans, are you ready for this?
Yeah, they did a boycott.
Less than 25% of the people in New Orleans watched the Super Bowl, and their main paper, the headline the next day was Super Bowl. What Super Bowl?
What's the name of the paper?
The Times. Oh, see.
Yeah.
Pick a. You do it.
No, I know what it is.
Well, just say it.
I don't speak Creole. It's Creole. The Times Picayune.
The Times Picayune. Yeah. Their headline was Super Bowl. What Super Bowl?
Yeah, all right.
I love it.
All right, get over
it.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. State of the Union address tonight, 8 p.m., will be on these airwaves, broadcast on AM 560, so you can listen in here. And the question I have is, should Trump use the occasion of the State of the Union address to declare an emergency at the border and move to invoke what he believes are the executive's emergency powers to fund a border barrier, or should he continue to abide the February 15th deadline, continue to try to work or allow the bipartisan committee House members to work towards a deal, and if they don't get a deal, then shut down the government again on the 15th? What would you say? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Your advice and counsel for the president on the choice before him.
Yeah, well, I agree. I think it's the perfect time with a nation, an audience from people all over the country, and he can make his case. He's bringing people, family members whose loved ones have been killed by those here illegally. He's bringing survivors of the synagogue massacre, and he's bringing that six-year-old kid whose last name is Trump, who's been bullied at school. He's also going to be in the audience. But it's a great time to say, look, because they're not going to budge. The Dems are not going to budge on border wall funding. So just put your foot down, declare a national emergency, and that's it. And then there's no possibility of a second government shutdown.
Well, there is, because here's what will happen if he invokes his emergency powers. He'll face a suit by Democrats to enjoin the exercise of those emergency powers. They'll seek to get an injunction to stop him. So they'll find a favorable federal court that would issue such an injunction. In addition to that, one reading of statutory law in this topic area suggests that the House can move to essentially override the president's declaration, to reject the emergency declaration thereby stalling him in the House, and then it would potentially be taken up in the Senate. And so you sort of have the same dynamic that you have now. So, you know, process-wise, it's not so simple for him to just to declare and then repurpose funds to the Army Corps of, you know, to funds allocated for domestic projects to the Army Corps of Engineers to continue construction of the border barrier, the wall, the fencing, what have you. It's a little bit more complicated.
Lindsey Graham says now's the time for the president to send a strong message.
To every Republican, if you don't stand behind this president, we're not going to stand behind you when it comes to the wall. This is the defining moment of his presidency. It's not just about a wall. It's about him being treated different than every other president.
Yeah, so just again on the National Emergency Act, it requires Trump to identify the other specific statute delegating emergency powers he's invoking. And then there's several statutes that authorize military officials and a presidentially declared emergency to redirect funds for the purposes that are either essential to the national defense or support of the use of armed forces. But this would be litigated, as I said. And potentially you could have House action in addition to litigation. So what about the prospect, or what about rather than doing that tonight?
Yeah.
What about just resetting the table with a compromise he proposed a couple weekends back that I think, if it wasn't Trump offering it, would have broad support among the American electorate? And just pounding that compromise position that gives Democrats a lot of what they've wanted, and Republicans too, with respect to Dreamers, extension of legal status for DACA designees, and also border security enhancements in the context of a holistic approach to border security. I think if he just sort of reasonably sets out the four corners of what he's previously proposed, Stacey Abrams and every other Democrat is going to have a difficult time addressing the substance of what he offered. They'll just attack the person making the offer, which is indicative of the weak intellectual ground on which they stand. That, to me, seems to play. And, hey, look, if you don't want to be reasonable, remember this is the compromise. So now everybody's heard it. So if you think this is a reasonable compromise, then you should tell your Democrats in the House to get behind it. Some are behind it. Remember, 30 Democrat legislators have sent a letter to Pelosi saying we want to do a deal. Mark Warner and other senators, Democrat senators, have suggested they're open to the idea of some border security funding for infrastructure, meaning in addition, meaning including a wall, Joe Manchin as well. So why not just lay that out? And if you can't come to that reasonable compromise that has supermajority public support, then we'll go ahead and shut down the government, you know, partial shut down the government again, and we'll just play this out.
I just got a text message saying, forget the wall. We should stop giving illegal immigrants free stuff. Then they won't come here.
Well, okay, but, I mean, that's not sort of the issue at bar. The issue at bar is getting a deal on border security and using that as the foundation for a larger conversation about immigration policy in this country. And it's important for Trump to get this done.
Yeah, that's why, I mean, he campaigned on it. The theme for tonight, though, by the way, Dan, is choosing greatness. They have a theme that they came out
with. Okay. All right. And we'll get to all of the Lenny Skutniks as well, all of the invitees of the president
oh, yes.
at the moment. Michael in Oak Forest, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning.
Morning.
I understand there's still construction working on the California wall. Can they stop doing anything there?
Well, right. I mean, this is Trump's point, is that there is ongoing activity. Thanks for the call, Michael. Ongoing activity.
Already in place. They've been working on it for almost a year.
Right. And so here's the curious position of the Democrats. This is you've authorized resources for border barriers before. There's work ongoing. If this makes no sense, if this is immoral, as Pelosi said, then why don't you just tear it all down? Why don't you move to tear it all down and send that to my desk? Resources to tear down all of the physical barriers on the border. And let's start with San Diego, Nancy Pelosi. What say you to that? You know, framing this tonight and how Trump does it is going to be very important. There is a lot of substance on his side, so I hope he prosecutes that case. Deborah in Arlington Heights.
Good morning.
Morning.
I would announce it this evening and, you know, lay out your case like you said, and if they will not move forward, then I would do an emergency action. I just want to say, if the government shuts down again, just a quick note. With the last government shutdown, when I was going online to pay my bills, pretty much on every place that I was going to pay my bills, there was a big header saying, if you've been affected by the government shutdown, you know, we can help or whatever. I'm paraphrasing.
Right.
So, and I know those people all got back pay. I wouldn't want to go to that again because I think that we should just take a harder line. The Democrats are never going to, Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer are not going to agree with the president no matter what he does.
Thanks for the call. That's probably true, but again, the president did agree to this extension to February 15th, so shouldn't he let that play out to again, demonstrate that he has done and said everything he would do. He has done and said everything he said he would do. He's trying to do the things he promised to do as president, and it puts Pelosi and Pagliacci in an increasingly difficult position, doesn't it? Bob and Schomburg, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I just have to look back and say, why in the heck didn't Paul Ryan handle this when he was a Speaker of the House?
Yeah, there's no question. It's a failure of Republicans, congressional Republicans. Thanks, Bob. And as I said before, and I know some Trump loyalists don't like this, but failure of the president. You know, strike while the iron's hot. You've got your party in control. Take a hard line with Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell to get this done straight away in your first 2 years when you know you've got control of the legislative branch as well, rather than putting yourself or allowing yourself to be in the position you find yourself in now. So, yes, Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell, President Trump, they had a window of opportunity they let close on them. Jim in Tampa, Florida.
Good morning. I think that what should happen is he should let the deadline play out because he said he would. But I think he should very boldly announce that the exact steps that will take place at the stroke of midnight on the day of the deadline. And he should lay them out one by one and then begin sort of the way they do for hurricanes, staging resources, start putting things into place, very publicly putting things into place. One of them might be to tear that wall down in San Diego. And some things of that nature. I also wouldn't be surprised to see President Trump call individuals out by name and directly right there in the hall. Something bold like that. Wouldn't be surprised because he's different. But those are my thoughts.
Thanks for the call, Jim. What if he did like a Dan Aykroyd and turned around to Nancy Pelosi and said, Nancy, you ignorant slut?
Will you stop it?
Do you think that would go over
well? I mean,
well?
This is good. I wanted to see the dichotomy between those two. I think they're going to be joking around a little bit with each other. I think she'll be giving him smug looks, and then he'll be looking at her like, Nancy. And then she'll be, Donald.
Well, he won't see her because she's behind
him.
I
know, but I think he's going to turn around and they'll make some gesture.
But you can't.
Gesture.
I mean, you won't. Everybody's like, oh, we're going to watch the body language. Her face doesn't move. So you don't have any facial expressions from Nancy Pelosi. You just have that, like, frightened raccoon on the porch when you flip the light on look.
I think the Botox is lightening up a little so she can move her eyebrows.
Mm. Larry and Bartlett.
Hey, good morning. Good morning, Dan and Amy. Sorry about that. Dan, you answered my question before about some senators. Maybe Trump can offer a deal. I'll tell you what, guys. I'll back off the wall. You, the Senate, pass a resolution approving all 167 judges that are held up by all of your silly actions.
Oh, interesting. Made a deal on the, on the judicial nominee. So thanks for the call, Larry. I mean, the judicial nominees are important, and he should press on that. But, you know, you do have a majority in the Senate, so McConnell should press on that. I still think he's got to get a deal done on border security.
Oh, he has to.
So this is
what he campaigned on. It's what everybody is expecting.
This is priority one. Craig in Mount Greenwood.
Yeah, Dan, Two things. One would be a like a preemptive move of some sort to exclude the states that have the judges, the activist judges that would, you know, have standing. So just remove them out of the emergency order. And the other thing is to do an executive order that any of these activist judges that interfere, that if they're found it like it was, you know, they didn't have, they were interfering with the security of the country, that there would be a punishment involved.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Greg. The president doesn't have the power to do that unilaterally, and that's sort of a good thing, right? You don't want the president being able to unilaterally, effectively impeach federal judges because he doesn't like their judicial philosophy. No, that's not possible or appropriate. Tom in Deer Park.
Good morning. Reasonable people can agree or disagree what constitutes an emergency. I don't believe this is, but let's just say for argument's sake, people in the conservative movement do. Donald Trump campaigned on a wall and that Mexico would pay for the wall. We had a Republican Congress in 2 years and he couldn't get it done. Now I'm hearing people from the conservative movement say that the president of the United States should declare an emergency and build it and pay for it with our money. So if this is what the conservative movement's come to, put a fork in it, because enjoy yourself, people, when President Kamala Harris or President Bernie Sanders in 2021 declares an emergency on green power or guns and says we have an emergency on guns and we're coming to take them. Enjoy yourselves and then thank yourselves for what you believed in the year 2019.
All right. Thanks for the call, Tom. I mean, there is the issue of the precedent that you set and the left taking that and expanding upon it or applying it in other areas where you don't want that sort of federal intervention. Now, there's arguments to be made against both of those things and distinguish them from an area of policymaking where the executive has a lot of constitutionally guaranteed authority, and that's with respect to immigration. But your point is a fair one.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, and Amy, you mentioned a couple of the people that are guests of the president tonight for the State of the Union Address. Timothy Mattson is one. One of the police officers suffered multiple gunshot wounds when a shooter opened fire at the Tree of Life Synagogue. Mm-hmm. Daughter, great-granddaughter, and granddaughter of Gerald and Sharon David, who were murdered in their home in Nevada by a person in this country illegally.
Yeah, I don't think people realize that. The guy who came here illegally from El Salvador, that didn't get a lot of attention.
Imagine that.
And I don't know if it's because they were elderly or what, but they, sorry, old people out there, but it didn't get a lot of attention, so they're bringing that family members. They're bringing 13 people total. Josh Trump, that sixth grader in Wilmington, Delaware, not related to President Trump, but he has been invited and
because he was
bullied because of his name.
Yeah, right.
People are saying that, I mean, just horrible things to him, calling him an idiot and stupid. And it got to the point where they actually changed his name in the school system.
To Melania.
Exactly. And now everything's fine. They're going to go reading together. But you know what? I'm surprised this person's on the list. Alice Johnson. Well, she's the 63-year-old woman whose sentence was reversed.
Well, he granted her clemency.
But after TV stars, you know, Kim Kardashian West and Kanye got involved. But she'll be there,
too. She was life sentenced for nonviolent drug and money laundering charges. Also, first prisoner's release as a result of the First Step Act and a woman recovering from an opioid addiction as well. And you know where the genesis of this comes, this inviting guests and, you know, then others invite guests, too. Like Marco Rubio's inviting the chargé d'affaires for... the chargé d'affaires from the Venezuelan embassy for would-be new president of Venezuela, Guaido. So, you know, just pointing out support for democracy and the completion of the Guaido revolt in Venezuela.
And three Democrats are not going, which I'm sure you could guess who they are. John Lewis.
Hank Johnson. Hank Johnson's attending to the crisis in Guam.
Making sure it doesn't tip over.
Correct.
And some other Democrat from Tennessee. But I'm going to be looking to see if Ruth Bader Ginsburg will be there. I probably doubt it, but
we'll see
what Supreme Court justices show up.
You know the genesis of this tradition. Ronald Reagan.
Oh, yeah.
and Lenny Skutnik,
retired
employee for the Congressional Budget Office, who saved a woman when there was a commercial flight that crashed.
Oh,
in
that's
Potomac.
Right, the Potomac.
Yeah.
Oh, that was amazing. Have you seen that documentary?
This is Reagan calling out Skutnik.
Just 2 weeks ago, in the midst of a terrible tragedy on the Potomac, we saw again the spirit of American heroism at its finest. The heroism of dedicated rescue workers saving crash victims from icy waters. And we saw the heroism of one of our young government employees, Lenny Skutnik, who, when he saw a woman lose her grip on the helicopter line, dived into the water and dragged her to safety.
Yeah, Lenny. All right, Lenny. Yeah, so nice moment. I think the tradition has sort of been bastardized beyond all recognition, but, you know, it's something.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. It's Black History Month. Are you paying attention to the Black Lives Matter political agenda being introduced into your kids' classrooms? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. Yeah, well, it's happening. Let me give you an example. Oh, our friends up there in Evanston, Skokie, District 65, we've talked about that district before.
Skokieston, we call it.
This is the district where the principal, in her infant wisdom, segregated faculty by race. Oof. For training and evaluation sessions. The district where we went through the sex ed curriculum at like the primary grade level, where, I mean, not to repeat it, but everything under the sun, graphically, to, you know, again, kids in the primary grades. Here's Black School Week, which is happening right now. I've got the whole week's program I'll run through with you so you feel like you're there. BLM at School Week. Send your child to school during BLM Week wearing all black. BLM t-shirts or BLM buttons. You can purchase or make your own shirts with your child. A point of order, or just a question. Can you show up in blackface? I'm asking for a friend of mine in Virginia.
Okay. Funny.
This week, every school and classroom in District 65 will participate to support and take action for Black Lives in District 65 by educating all children around the understanding of BLM during Black History Month and to stand in solidarity with BLM at School National Week of Action. All students will experience at least one BLM lesson. There will be daily announcements about BLM. There will be a Black Student Affinity Gathering, students only, on Wednesday, February 6th at Fleetwood Jourdain on Wednesday, February 6th at 12:30 p.m. During our half day hosted by Dr. Latarsha Green, Director of Black Student Success, and Mrs. Jari White, Equity Instructional Coach. Oh, man. Instructional Coach.
Did you have one of those?
Please participate in this important week. And then there's resources. Here's the program. Yesterday.
And let's see.
Today we are going to learn about three of the Black Lives Matter guiding principles. Restorative justice, empathy, and loving engagement. Restorative justice. We all know that if you knock someone's building block, or you knock down someone's block building, you have to help them rebuild it. You can't just say sorry and walk away. We know that it's important for the kids to be able to make better choices another time, and it's grown-ups' job to help them make better choices and give them chances to do that. Restorative justice, that's a synonym for reparations. That's what they're going to be taught. Okay. Empathy, loving engagement, you know, pro forma pablum. Tuesday. Today we're going to learn about two of the Black Lives Matter guiding principles, diversity and globalism. Different people do different things and have different feelings. It's so important that we have lots of different kinds of people in our community that everyone feels safe. That's diversity. Yeah. As I want to say, diversity doesn't need a chaperone. It occurs naturally.
Is it diversity a wooden ship?
It was just, yes, correct. Correct. Thank you, Ron Burgundy. Globalism means that we are thinking about all the different people are over the world. Nice English. How about
really
copyediting this thing? Yes.
Oh my God.
And thinking about the ways to keep things fair everywhere. Talk more with your teacher, peers, and families about these principles. All right.
Okay.
You having fun so far? You enjoying the week?
You know what? That's great.
Wednesday, three more Black Lives Matter guiding principles. Transgender affirming, queer affirming, and collective value. Now we're getting to it. Everybody has the right to choose their own gender by listening to their own heart and mind. Everyone gets to choose if they are a boy or a girl, or both, or neither, or something else, and no one else gets to choose for them. Not their chromosomes, not God. Queer affirming. That's transgender affirming. Queer affirming. Everybody has the right to choose who they love and the kind of family they want to, by listening to their own heart and mind. Collective value. Everybody is important and has the right to be safe and happy no matter what they believe, where they are from, or who they love, unless they're a white male Christian. That's my parenthetical remark. Another way to say that is collective value. So there you go. Collectivism, you're your own God. All good stuff. Yeah. What a week of instruction. Today.
Yeah, what do we have for today?
Thursday. Well, that was.
No, today is.
Well, I know. Went past Tuesday. That was just Wednesday.
I mean, all right. Well, what's
Thursday? We're on Thursday now. I'm just giving you
any
a preview of the week.
Any day that ends in Y, I need to know.
I'd like to share what intergenerational Black families and Black villages means. Intergenerational. It's important that we have spaces where people of different ages can come together and learn from one another. Black families, lots of different kinds of families. What makes a family is that it's people who take care of each other. It's important to make sure all families feel welcome. Black villages, lots of different kinds of families. What makes families that it's people who take care of each other. Those people might be related. Or maybe they choose to be family together and take care of each other in some other format. Sometimes when it's lots of families together, it can be called a village.
Oh, boy.
The consultants, by the way, that come in with this, you know, six figures. Your tax dollars at work. Friday, closing out the week with a bang. Two more Black Lives Matter guiding principles. Centering Black women and unapologetically Black. There's some people who think that women are less important than men. We know that all people are important and have the right to be safe and talk about their own feelings. This is like a bad Stuart Smalley.
It is.
Parody. You're smart enough, you're good enough, and I mean, doggone it,
people
like you.
Me.
There are different, unapologetically Black, there are different kinds of people, and one way that we're different is the color of our skin. Yeah, it's important to make sure that all people are treated fairly, and that's why we and lots of other people all over the country, the world, are part of the Black Lives Matter movement, because that's what it really is. As you've seen from the Black Lives Matter movement in practice and the purveyors of it in politics, it's all about color blindness and making sure everybody is treated fairly, equal justice before the law, and all of that, right? Yeah. I'll tell you what, here's the thing. You can offer up your pablum if you want. I would just like one parent in District 65, like happened in New Trier when they were doing their We Hate White People seminar day, to say, I'll tell you what, I'd like to bring in an alternative viewpoint on the Black experience. So is it okay if we invite my friend Bob Woodson or Thomas Sowell or Walter Williams or Jason Riley or John McWhorter to come and address the students, their experience? Is it okay if we read some of the offerings of, say, a Frederick Douglass or a Booker T. Washington? Would that be acceptable? Where is one parent in these school districts to stand up and not even fight the fight of this intellectual violence? Just say, you have your say, and you present your materials, and let somebody else have their say that comes from a different perspective with the similar experience and, frankly, more experience, some of the names I mentioned, than any of these cultural Marxist consultants that are retained by the school districts in terms of the Black struggle against racist institutions in this country. Many of the names I mentioned that are in their 80s who actually lived through it were marching with King in the 60s. What about that? One parent. Is there not one parent in School District 65 in Evanston and Skokie? What about your school districts? where your kids are. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Jeff and Berwyn, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Greetings, Dan and Amy.
Hello.
This Black History Month, maybe they should include the entire history of blacks in Africa, how the African warlords, black African warlords, sold their conquered tribes into slavery. And also, you remember the quote by Muhammad Ali, which is on YouTube? I'm glad my grandfather, maybe his great-grandfather, was on that ship. This thing about Black History Month is great, but include it all, how they actually became transatlantic slaves. And also, by the way, the Arab Muslim slave trade, which brutalized the black Africans, castrating them to make them eunuchs.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Jeff. I mean, it's...
Well, Black History Month has been around, I mean, since February 1970.
Yeah, and so?
Not celebrating it, but it's been, you know, indoctrinated into our school system.
It's not about having a Black History Month It's about the curriculum.
Curriculum, right. That's when... But when we went over Black History Month, it wasn't like that.
Well, this
it was just looking at black historical figures and how they've changed the culture and how... In America, that's what it was. Honoring Martin Luther King Jr., learning about him.
How about
listening to his speeches? That's what I remember Black History Month.
Black History Month. How about asking the kids the question and having a little discussion about have we lived up to the promise of Brown v. Board of Education to eliminate separate but equal in education? Have we done that? Well, I mean, has your side done that in charge of K-12 education? In every major city in this country, all of the cultural institutions. Have you done that? Why not? Government schools, segregated, Chicago. Why does separate but equal persist in a de facto manner when all of these enlightened cultural Marxists are in charge? I don't understand. Help me. Help me understand. Mike on the north side.
Good morning. Yes, happy Black History Month. Let's celebrate diversity and the failure it is. It's just a nice way of saying affirmative action. And that's all well and good until you...
No, I don't know what happened to Mike. All right.
Don't take it personally.
Mark in Plainfield.
Happy Chinese New Year, Dan and Amy.
Thank you.
I believe it's the year of the snake. It's speaking of snakes. What about the
pig.
Myth of the black man? If they're embracing this transgender stuff, I thought the part that made us bad was the most manliest of the black man. So are they giving up that myth?
Wait, what? Mark. Okay, Mark. Would you stop?
Please.
Come on. Candace in Mount Pleasant.
Well, they sure are lucky that I don't have my imaginary kids in that school district, Dan.
Yes.
You keep seeing me on the news. But, hey, listen, this whole trans thing, the second day you said, is so creepy. I heard about this there's a YouTube video, everybody should watch it, from an Austin teacher who had to go through 6 hours of trans training. And she said that they would slip this into the BLM day. And that's how they get it through. And they also don't tell the parents that what they're teaching.
No.
They don't ever tell those parents, by the way, we're going to be teaching. Because it's not about acceptance. It's actually about grooming your kids.
Well, right.
And shaming the hetero kids and saying, isn't gay love beautiful?
Yes, Candace, thanks for the call. But here's the thing. If I can find out about it, then certainly parents in District 65. Or parents in other school districts.
Well, sometimes it just pops up on you. I mean, yesterday, Peyton spent his whole music hour breaking down the halftime Super Bowl show with the teacher saying that they're trying to, to get the African-American crowd back in watching the NFL because the NFL is racist, because the NFL, there's domestic violence going on.
Wait,
because there's a black
racist because there's domestic violence going
on. They're racist because of Colin Kaepernick. And they are wife beaters because of Ray Rice and other people. I'm like, you learned that during music class? Then I had to set them straight. And they thought it was racist because Martin Luther King Jr.'s family members were there doing the coin toss. And I said, well, they live there, and the Super Bowl took place in Atlanta. So Atlanta wants to feature their own. That's why Gladys Knight performed. She's a daughter of Georgia. It's not because they're trying to attract black people back into the NFL.
I'm so confused. So having a descendant of Martin Luther King Jr. there was racist?
Yep.
How?
Because they thought they were placating to African Americans. Like, take us back. The NFL loves you. We love black people.
Well, so what if the NFL was marketing to, I mean, I'm not saying that's the case, but so right. What if the NFL was marketing to black families? You don't have consumer products that market specifically to racial or age demographics or whatever? I mean, should Billy Williams not do Colt 45 commercials because that was marketing to black people, black guys? I don't even understand what the hell's going on.
Well, that's why I'm saying this. You should talk to your kids about what they're being taught during school.
Yeah, I'd say.
And he came home with that, and I went, what?
And
it was racist because there was a black gospel choir behind Maroon 5 singing in one of their songs.
Well, so the other thing that has to happen then when you have some ignoramus teaching your children is that ignoramus needs to be confronted. Otherwise, the poisoning will
continue. You and I are going to Allman Brothers High School today to talk to him.
Okay.
Noon.
And that will be the last day Peyton or Eli ever step foot in Allman Brothers. Maurice and Berwyn, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, Dan. Hey, Dan, when I was a kid, Black History Month was just a reminder of all the contributions that African Americans made. But my viewpoint being African American was we had that term, people were a tribute to their race. And I had older parents. But you talked about Diane Carroll, say Julia, Nat King Cole, even Frederick Douglass, Martin Luther King, all these great African American role models.
Yeah. Right.
I didn't need, like, I don't want to be treated specially. I don't want to walk into a room and say, hey, look at that black guy. I just want them to walk in and say, hey, that guy is maybe nice or not nice. It can become too much. I don't need to know that my life's there. I think all lives matter. But I also think that African Americans, like anything else, have become more liberal.
Yeah, well, Maurice, I wish I could. I wish you could make the time to go up to District 65 to present that viewpoint. But it's just a viewpoint that not enough people are hearing. I mean, what you said is totally respectable and rational, and it has nothing to do with the curriculum in public schools as it pertains to race. Unfortunately, thanks for the call, Maurice. Glenn in Holland, Michigan.
Yes, they shouldn't call this Black History Month. They should call it SJW Month, Social Justice Warrior Month. This is not about black people. This is about social justice. I mean, what does transgender have to do with black people? Nothing. It was probably organized by a bunch of liberal white people, for Christ's sake.
Of course. Thanks for the call, Glenn. I mean, that's the whole intersectionality poison now that's in fashion among the cultural Marxists. And I just go back to something our friend Bob Woodson said. I long for the days of the honest bigot. I could confront the honest bigot, the patronizing liberal, particularly a patronizing white liberal that's in charge of many of these school systems. They're much worse than the honest bigot. That was Woodson's perspective.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
You want to be tough, better do what you can, so beat it. But you want to be bad, just beat it.
Dan and Amy, should Virginia Governor Ralph Northam beat it? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. He is digging in, saying he's not going to resign because he doesn't want to be known as a racist for life.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Too bad. You kind of made that decision when you actually put the photos that appeared in your medical school yearbook in an envelope and sent it to the editor of the yearbook. Because that's what happened, by the way. I saw the editor of that 1984 Eastern Virginia Med School yearbook, and she said that's how they received the photos. There was no mix-up.
The designer of the 1984 yearbook in question said, to the best of my remembrance, and anything's possible, but it's not probable that it was another student's picture.
Yeah.
We didn't take that kind of security you do in the military with some things, but we did our best to make sure they were photos that people submitted. In my experience, the most likely thing is he submitted the picture. Is it possible somebody could have switched the pictures after the fact? Yes. Is it probable? No. And, you know, the picture, everybody's focused on the blackface.
Who's the dude next to him in the Klan outfit is what I've been asking.
Well, not only who is it, but the
fact that he did it.
The existence of it. I mean, the blackface is insulting and, you know, obviously calls to mind these the derogatory minstrel shows. The Klan was a murderous organization. And by the way, this is 1984. I just want to repeat that.
Who dresses up in a Klan uniform ever? I mean, that's sick.
So, I mean, I understand the Democrats embrace members of the Klan to lead their caucuses in Congress, like Bob Byrd. I understand that. So I understand the Democrats' long history with the Klan. I get that. So stipulated. I just want to make sure everybody understands the Democrats' long history with the Klan. Okay. But should Northam resign?
312-642-5600 is our turnkey DAPRO answer line. 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
I assume you were on the fence until you heard Governor Jelly Belly weigh in and say he should, and that pushed you over.
What? Governor Jelly Belly. You mean J.B. Pritzker? No, here's the thing. He did. Part of me, I'm really divided on this because it happened in 1984. Poor judgment. But he wasn't. It wasn't a youthful indiscretion because he was a young man. I mean, he was in his mid-20s. I would never have done that. But are we going to go back into everyone's yearbooks? I mean, doesn't it make you want to check your book to make your yearbook to make sure everything's fine? No, because
not really. Not worried about it. But here's the. I've heard these arguments. I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think you can say Ralph Northam should resign because he's lost the moral standing to be the chief executive of state, and at the same time say that this idea of going back and looking at we're just at college and high school yearbooks, then we'll have grade school yearbooks, and we'll find out about people in kindergarten who didn't share well with others, and that will eliminate them from consideration. But I think what you're seeing is a concern about, you know, looking for any past indiscretion, any past error in judgment, and saying that so defines the person. I get that concern, but I think you can express that concern and suggest that something should be out of bounds or should be treated in context of an entire life, but also at the same time say Northam's error in judgment here, in addition to that wild press conference he had on Saturday, are disqualifying.
Here's the thing. He went from apologies to denial to an indecision, and he said that he needs more time. But I don't think, Dan, that he understands the severity of what he did. I mean, if you watch that four-minute chaotic press conference, he was about to, folks, do the moonwalk, get from behind his lectern out to the media to do his moonwalk, and his wife is the one who stopped him and said, "That's inappropriate." She mumbled under her breath, but you can hear her saying that.
Why don't we have
like
him?
He's enjoying this publicity. It's so weird.
Well, I don't know about that, but why don't we have him do his rendition of "Dirty Diana" and let that be the basis on which we issue a final verdict? What do you think?
I want him to do the moonwalk. Let's see if he really did this at a San Antonio dance off in the 80s. It's so goofy.
Well, and just remember, and just when you think, oh, well, then you just usher in Justin Fairfax, the, as Jennifer Rubin of the Washington Post called him, the charismatic African-American. Like, well, I mean, the sort of patronizingly racist comment that Jennifer Rubin made, Bezos Post blogger. But Justin Fairfax is waiting in the wings, supposed to be like a rising star in Democrat politics. And then he's beset by allegations from a woman who's been named publicly, Vanessa Tyson, that at the 2004 Democrat National Convention in Boston, when Fairfax was a staffer for John Kerry's presidential campaign, he sexually assaulted her. She sent a message to a friend that she authorized to be made public. "Imagine you were sexually assaulted during the DNC in Boston in 2004 by a campaign staffer. You spend the next 13 years trying to forget it ever happened until one day you find out he's the Democrat candidate for statewide office in a state some 3,000 miles away, and he wins the election in November 2017. Then by strange, horrible luck, it seems increasingly likely that he'll get a very big promotion." Ms. Tyson, now professor at Scripps College.
I'd love to hear, I mean, no
He said it was consensual, Dan, and he is standing by that.
You now have something that was 15 years ago, and yet you still don't have a shred of corroboration, a shred of evidence. Again, this was first posed a year ago, and it went to the Washington Post, by the way. And then when the Washington Post made the decision not to run the story because it is false, because it is uncorroborated, the reason it's uncorroborated is because it's false, you just go away until you find another opportunity to get back in the media.
Uh-huh. And so is that the standard, though? I mean, unfortunately, the Democrats chose their standard with their treatment of Brett Kavanaugh. We're supposed to believe women. Doesn't matter if there's corroboration or not. Doesn't matter if there's gaps in memory of the story or not. You're supposed to believe women because the Bezos Post decided not to publish a story against a Democrat candidate.
It's a big while shocker
they,
there.
While they ran with all of the uncorroborated stories and stories that turned out to be false, demonstrably false against Kavanaugh. I'm sorry, Justin Fairfax. What say you to that? What say all the Democrats who piled on Brett Kavanaugh, who said Blasey Ford is to be believed as a matter of course, no questions asked, no corroboration or evidence needed. We're to dismiss 150 women who stand up at a presser for Brett Kavanaugh who have interacted with him over the course of his maturation and professional career. That's all to be pushed aside. I mean, I won't do the witch hunt that they did, but I want to point it out because it separates people who are intellectually honest from the mob. And that's what the Democrat Party in this country is today. It is a cultural Marxist mob. And now Justin Fairfax and Ralph Northam don't like it so much. It's funny how you can't control the mob. It's funny when the yearbook police come for the yearbook police, isn't it? Tom on the South Side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
As much as I abhor the guy, I kind of don't want to see him have to resign because you're not the same person 25 years ago, and is it believable? I mean, of course, we were supposed to believe the crime talker, even though she didn't remember anything. But it's nice of their own to get their own medicine. You know, if you're a Democrat, you can make stuff up while you're beating up your girlfriend, and they're all good with it. A la Keith Ellison and...
I don't think he beat up his girlfriend.
Well, thanks for the call, Tom. I mean, this is something where we exercised with Shannon and Keith Ellison when we discussed those allegations. There were some gaps in her story. Who are unwilling here? I have a tape. I'm not going to produce a tape. I don't have a tape.
Well, I try to exercise that's problematic. Restraint no matter what political party they're involved in, and that's why I'm stuck on this Northam thing. Because what he did, yeah, that was stupid and silly, but his response to it is worse than what he did, in my mind.
Well,
I mean, pick a story and stick with it, really.
Well, okay, I mean, but the judgment of, forget even the bizarre Michael Jackson dance contest impersonator business, the judgment of the Klan and the blackface, especially the Klan. The Klan was a murder, I mean, I can't say, murdered people.
I know. And
this isn't just insulting people. This isn't just a physical representation of an epithet. This is an organization that was involved in mayhem and murder.
And lynchings and burn. I know.
Well, that's, yes.
Cross burnings, the whole
right.
thing.
So,
yeah, he wasn't trying to be a ghost, guys. That was a Klan guy.
It's a little bit more than that. It's a little bit more than that. The Ralph Northam stay and why the Democrats should want him to go so much is because, right, he's an albatross around their neck. He is a living reminder of their hypocrisy. And they like to deny their hypocrisy and hope most people are unable to connect the dots, which seems to be the case in places like Illinois. Not everywhere, though. So I understand why some conservatives say, yeah, let's keep him there because he's politically useful. But in terms of the merits, whether he has the standing to be a governor, no. Uh-uh. Not to me. Mike in Union.
Morning, Dan and Amy. How are you?
Morning.
Hey, it sounds like karma is having its Spartacus moment with these Democrats. Kind of nice to see it come back at them.
Yeah, it is. Thanks for the Spartacus reference, Mike. John in the North Burbs.
I just think it's pretty interesting. We're not even talking about these were his most formative years. We're not talking about kindergarten or high school. This is med school, and he didn't remember that. That's kind of laughable.
Thanks for the call, John. Yeah, I mean, the whole,
I know,
admit it, I'm sorry for that. Oh, wait, that's not me in either one of those pictures. That's not, neither one of those photos is me, but I misremembered. And then I remembered after consultation with a committee I formed because, you know, I was so used to dressing in blackface that, you know, I thought, oh, well, of course that's me initially.
But then asking, like, you know, and asking people out in the crowd or the reporters there, any of you ever dressed up? It's hard to take it off your face. And the majority of the reporters that are there are African-American, and it's staring at him like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
He's an idiot.
Yeah. And all the people that were flacking for him as a candidate against Gillespie, well, all the people that were running interference for him when he and his leftist allies were engaged in racist demagoguery in the direction of Gillespie and Republicans.
One of his biggest supporters is former President Barack Obama, and he has remained radio silent on this.
Well, sure.
He has not said a word.
Obama signed off on a he signed off on a fundraising letter for Bob Byrd when he was a senator. Ah, just let that, you know, let his little dalliance with the Klan, you know, let's not get hung up on past indiscretions. Different time, isn't it? Another important point here, the politics of this locally, as in the state of Virginia, remember, odd year elections. So Northam was elected in 17, legislative elections in 19 this year. They're looking back to take the control of the House of Delegates, to take control of the legislature in Virginia, which they narrowly missed doing in 17. Mm-hmm. And what do you think? Do you think they want to be running with Northam? You think legislative candidates want to be running with Northam in the governor's office? They want this story to go away locally as well as nationally. Cindy and Jaliet.
Hey, good morning, Dan. Hi, Amy. You know, one of your callers brought this up, but, you know, this guy was in med school. He was on a precipice of a career where he had the control of life and death based on his decisions. And obviously, he did not have the ability to make a good decision. This was not some stupid frat boy, some goofy high school prank. This is a Democratic governor that doesn't have the common sense that God gave a goose. And he's an idiot because his wife has to reel him in and say, you know, basically don't moonwalk, even though you're pulled into all of that attention.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy needs to go, and I'm sick and tired of the double standard. I am sick to death of it, and he needs to go.
Thanks for the call, Cindy. So would you agree that Ralph Northam can stay if he wears the scarlet bejeweled single glove? If he did that, if he wore that around all the time as governor, as sort of a scarlet, you know, it was a worse scarlet letter. What about that? Yeah. Justin Fairfax, also less than an inspired figure in the face of the sexual assault allegation from Miss Tyson. He's looking for people to blame, too. At the same time, he's suggesting don't believe uncorroborated allegations like the one leveled at him. He's making uncorroborated allegations in the direction of some of his political competitors, Northam and the Richmond mayor.
Do you think Governor Northam is behind this allegation coming out now?
No, I have no indication of that.
But you seem to suggest that earlier.
I did not suggest it.
You're not hinting at all. You think Governor Northam had nothing to do with the fact
that
this allegation is out?
I have no information in that regard. But
what about Mayor Stoney?
Here's the thing. I will tell you what. You all, you're great reporters. And you'll get to digging, and you'll get to make some connections. And as I said earlier, facts matter.
Well, one of the women who's in this Facebook exchange is the husband of Mayor Stoney, the former policy director.
You're a great reporter.
So he's a wink and a nod that Mayor Stoney, he's talking about LeVar Stoney, who's the mayor of Richmond, Virginia, and also somebody interested in running for governor, as is Justin Fairfax, of course, because Northam, if he survives, one term limit for the Virginia governor. So he's up in 21 regardless. So, you know, before you fall in love with Justin Fairfax as some, you know, a breath of fresh air.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity, right before Joe Walsh at 5 on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And subpoenas issued by the Southern District of New York for Trump's inauguration committee. Trump was asked about the Mueller investigation. This is separate and distinct from the Southern District of New York's investigation. But Trump was asked about Russia, the Russian collusion investigation, in his pre-Super Bowl interview on Sunday. Margaret Brennan just reading down a list of questions. Not much of a dialogue there. And Trump, because he wasn't pressed, gave his pat answer on the topic.
Well, look, the Russia thing is a hoax. I have been tougher on Russia than any president, maybe ever, but than any president.
But when it comes to the investigation that the special counsel is conducting, I mean, 34 people have been charged here.
Okay, you ready? Of the 34 people, many of them were bloggers from Moscow, mm-hmm. or they were people that had nothing to do with me, had nothing to do with what they're talking about, or they were people that got caught telling a fib or telling a lie. I think it's a terrible thing that's happened to this country because this investigation is a witch hunt. It's a terrible witch hunt, and it's a disgrace.
Stays on message, and he's certainly right about the three dozen that the media likes to focus on. But again, the state of play with both investigations, the focus on the Mueller, Russia, that may be wrapping up soon. But don't forget about that Southern District of New York investigation, which Andy McCarthy has not forgotten about. He's written extensively about it since the beginning and suggested on more than one occasion that that's where Trump is in real legal jeopardy, the Mueller investigation, more political jeopardy, if you will. Andy McCarthy, former Chief Assistant U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, now, of course, contributing editor at Nash Review, joins us now. Andy, thanks for being with us again. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Gotcha. It's not great, but I'm here.
Okay, great. Thanks, Andy. So let's just start with the subpoenas that were issued to Trump's inauguration committee. Give us your insight on the importance of those subpoenas.
Yeah, well, I think, Dan, that the problem here for Trump is that the game has started in a way. The Southern District investigation...
You know, we've got a bad connection with you. Let's try to reset here. Let's try and see if we can get Andy in a better line so we can get his insights. So let's take a break and we'll try to effort Andy McCarthy and be right back.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer
on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, all right, let's see if we've got Andy McCarthy back. We got Andy? Andy, are you with us?
Hey, Dan, how are you?
All right, great. Andy McCarthy, of course, former Chief Assistant U.S. Attorney, Southern District of New York, contributing editor of National Review. Andy, we were talking about the subpoenas that were issued by the Southern District of New York to Trump's inauguration committee and the importance of those subpoenas, and you were offering your insight.
Yeah, well, I just think that the Southern District's been... on a very aggressive interpretation of the campaign finance laws, which ordinarily are not treated as felony offenses. They were in the case that Cohen pled guilty to two counts on. And the interesting thing there are a lot of people who are very knowledgeable about campaign finance law, like Brad Smith, who used to run the FEC, who say that these are not what Cohen pled guilty to, were not actually felonies, that he seems to have pled guilty in order to appease the prosecutors to something that may not actually have been an in-kind campaign contribution. So it's a pretty complex area, and it's tough to hazard a guess when you don't quite know what they're up to yet.
But just with the inauguration committee, I mean, would be under the rubric of campaign finance in terms of the investigation, right? That's sort of the four corners of their focus?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it's always possible, Dan, when you're talking about money, that they could be thinking about things like fraud and money laundering. But,
right,
you know, you're really speculating without knowing, you know, without having a better idea of exactly the trail they're on.
And how do you assess, since we haven't talked to you since it happened, the arrest of Roger Stone, the importance of that latest twist in the Mueller investigation, with some indication from the acting attorney general that his investigation will be concluding in the not too distant future?
Yeah, well, I think Whitaker's statement that the investigation is winding down is consistent with what we've been seeing for the last number of weeks, where
Mueller's actually transferred a number of the cases that he brought to other components of the Justice Department. They've staffed down a bit. They're letting the cooperators get sentenced, which you wouldn't ordinarily do if you were looking at their testimony coming in some big proceeding. But all that said, I think, you know, they just indicted Stone. He's going to trial, he says, so that's going to take a number of months to work itself out. He's still got an active grand jury. So when I think when Whitaker says, you know, it's nearing a conclusion, you know, everything's relative, especially when you have prosecutors talking about time.
Well, yeah. Well, what did you think of the overuse of police force and taking him into custody? I mean, you had a helicopter overhead. You had two armed vehicles nearby. You had 29 armed officers storming his house. This man, not a flight risk. Not a violent offender, and doesn't even have a passport, and the judge or whoever wrote off on that knew that. So do you think they're trying to taint the jury before the jury's even formed against Roger Stone?
I think the whole thing to me is a shameful episode. I don't want to suggest that the things that Stone is accused of are frivolous, because they're not. I mean, they look like they have him on, you know, some pretty black and white full statements to the congressional committee. The I must say, the witness tampering thing where he says to the guy, you know, pull a Nixon or do a Frankie Pentangeli, the character from Godfather Part Two.
Right.
Yeah. If I were Mueller, I would have hesitated to put that count in there for fear of fueling an insanity defense. I mean, that's how, you know, crazy that sounds. But it's, you know, look, witness tampering is a 20-year felony. You know, there's different gradations of witness tampering, but it's a serious offense. All that said, the overkill of the arrest and the way the indictment is crafted, I mean, the indictment is 20 pages of heavy breathing, and then we get to the end and there's nothing. I mean, basically you have seven process crimes against a non-member of the campaign, basically a hanger-on who isn't really a focal figure in what we've been told was the rationale for the investigation from the beginning, which is this whole idea of an espionage conspiracy between the Trump campaign and Russia. And I believe that these indictments, the way they're done, which is they use the indictment as a pretext to give a narrative about this hyped-up version of collusion, and then you flip to the last page and it's a bunch of process crimes. And then you couple it with these overkill arrests. The whole thing is—it looks to me like it's something that's intending to try to make this look a lot more serious than it is, because it was sold that is the rationale for having a special counsel in the first place as something that was much more ambitious than what we're going to end up with at the end.
I want to switch gears. We've got the President's State of the Union address tonight, and this is sort of the intersection of law and politics. You've written about the constitutionality of the president making a declaration of a national emergency to repurpose funds that have been allocated for other domestic projects, enlist the Army Corps of Engineers, and that matter. The intersection of the law, what you think the president can do, and the politics of it, do you think it would be wise for the president to use this opportunity to make the declaration? Or do you see this as sort of Pelosi and Schumer baiting him into doing that in advance of the February 15th deadline that he's otherwise signed off on, derailing those negotiations and marginalizing himself further on this topic?
Well, I think the cynical, hard-nosed interpretation of this is that the minute he declares a national emergency, they're going to tootle into court and some, you know, aggressive district judge is going to stay it and make it a nationwide stay. And then everybody can retreat to their corners, right? Because it'll be working its way through the courts for months. So, you know, I think there's some people who are pretty smart, like Lindsey Graham, who's a good lawyer and a pretty calculating politician. And he's one of the leading cheerleaders for the president declaring the national emergency. I think he's smart enough to know that maybe that's the way out of this whole thing, that, you know, what will end up happening is the judge will pull the plug on it about 15 seconds after Trump declares it. And then,
that'll be the end of the issue for a while. My instinct is that, you know, legally, I think the authority is there. He can do it. I wouldn't do it, but I think he could do it. I don't think it's a good thing for the law that the president has that power. What I've said from the beginning, though, is I think he's been very effective at calling people's attention to the crisis at the border, the security crisis. And what I worry about is the minute he declares an emergency, then the issue goes from the crisis, the security crisis at the border, to whether he's acting lawlessly or not. And I, you know, I'm not a political guy, I admit, but to me that deserves him.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. He's Andy McCarthy, former Chief Assistant U.S. Attorney, Southern District of New York, a contributing editor at nationalreview.com. Andy, thanks for joining us as always. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Have a great day.
You too.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So Joe Biden was tasked with finding a cure for cancer, but a small team of Israeli scientists might have beaten him to the punch, at least according to this report out last week in the Jerusalem Post that I read. And, you know, Amy,
a lot of people read that. We're like, what?
Well, sure.
It's a startling headline.
Jarring. And I'm sort of from the Ray Romano school of healthcare. So if I have a growth on one side of my body, as long as I have that same growth on the other side of my body, then I just figure the symmetry means it's fine.
Quickly, when was the last time you went to the doctor?
I had to do like the half-ass physical you have to do to get to keep your medical certificate for your private pilot's license.
Oh,
so
well, that's thank all goodness you fly.
Yeah, that's
someone's holding you accountable.
I basically I'm sort of the philosophy: you just rub dirt on it, walk it off. Generally speaking. But with cancer, that's a little bit more difficult.
Yeah,
from what
it
I
is.
Understand,
Neosporin's not going to cure that.
So it's this is fascinating. Now, with some of these reports on medical advances or medical concerns, sometimes the journalists don't always get it right. So, for some context and scale, it's always helpful to talk to a medical professional. So, on this topic, we're pleased to have Eric Donnelly. He's a doctor, a radiation oncologist, actually, at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Dr. Connolly, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Dan and Amy.
So one of the researchers said we'll be able to offer in a year's time a complete cure for cancer, this the Accelerated Evolution Biotechnologies executive. And they the way they talk about this, I guess they've done some trials with mice, they're starting to move into clinical trials, is that they can sort of design antibodies to combat cancerous cells where you have them. And this is sort of an innovation sort of on the scale of the innovations to treat HIV. That's my understanding, but enlighten us.
Yeah, well, they definitely made some pretty major claims here with this report. And the technology that they're talking about is something that's been utilized in some other modalities. In cancer, we do have some different targeted therapies as well. You know, we have our antibody therapy, there's immunotherapy. Here they're kind of talking about a little bit different technology where they're going to be introducing several types of antibodies kind of at the same time to attack cancer from kind of many different angles. It sounds a little bit too good to be true, and I think it might be.
Well, do you think it was highly irresponsible for the Israeli company to claim that they have a cure for cancer?
I do. You know, there's the kind of the headline statement, the effective from day one, the last just a few weeks, and we'll have no or minimal side effects.
Right.
I mean, each one of those statements is a little bit, in its own right, you know, a major kind of red flag.
Now, other doctors I've heard talking about this on television shows and whatnot have said, you know, first of all, cure is sort of the wrong word. It's a treatment. And that what we're potentially on the cusp of with this advance is a more effective treatment for certain types of cancer than we have at present, sort of exercising a little bit more restraint and qualification. Is that strike you as more accurate?
Yeah, that'd be something I would, you know, hope to be accurate. because within cancer, there's many different types. And so to think that, you know, one treatment could have this kind of an effect across the board, you know, kind of an overreach, to say the least.
With respect to the treatments for cancer now, the advances of medicine over the years, and we look back and say, well, we were treating this malady this way, and boy, that was a wrong way to do it. Are we going to look back, do you think, and say, for example, chemotherapy, radiation treatment was the wrong way to treat cancer when we were doing it in the context of perhaps innovations like we're discussing here?
We may very well, because at some point, you know, hopefully we have something that mimics these statements in terms of the, you know, less side effects, you know, effective for all. But right now, those are the technologies that we have, and for the vast majority of patients, they work, and they work well.
Well, what
do come with some side effects.
Right.
Well, and I heard one of my dear friends is fighting colon cancer right now, and his chemotherapy is in a pill form. When did that come to the forefront? Sure. I had no idea that they were using that.
Yeah, we think of chemotherapy as always being the same type of chemotherapy where it's delivered through an IV and you're nauseous and lose your hair. But there's many different types of chemotherapy some are pill-based, some are delivered via shot or injection. So the pill-based forms have been around for about 5 to 8 years, becoming more prevalent in different types of cancer. Obviously, it's a big convenience to the patients not have to come in for an infusion every time when they can take a medication at home.
I want to go back to what these Israeli scientists offered in terms of a comparison, since we've seen advances in medicine be able to so much better treat HIV patients. One of the researchers equating it to the triple drug cocktail that's helped change AIDS from being automatic death sentence to chronic but manageable disease. He said, we used to give AIDS patients several drugs, but we would administer them one at a time. During the course of the treatment, the virus mutated and the AIDS started attacking again. Only when patients started using a cocktail were they able to stop the disease. And that's what he's comparing their treatment to, sort of a personalized cocktail version of cancer treatment. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, and I think that's kind of an attempt that we've been using for a while now. Most of the chemotherapies, when we deliver them in combination with a couple regimens. Sometimes we're limited in terms of how many chemotherapeutics we can give at the same time because of the possibility of side effects. I agree with most of what they've said here is that I think the next step in terms of the cure of cancer is not going to be just to eradicate cancer, but to make it in terms of more of like a HIV status where someone lives with the disease for, you know, a long period of time, and it's something that's more manageable for patients.
He suggested, again, I mentioned a cusp of beginning a round of clinical trials that he expects could be completed. This is one researcher speaking on behalf of the company, could be completed within a few years and would make the treatment available in specific cases. Is that also realistic that something like this, even in experimental form, could come online in a few years?
Highly unlikely based on what they've presented so far in terms of the cell lines that they're going to. You know, you have to go from here to, you know, larger mouse-based models, and then from there into some human subjects. But even there, you're going to be starting with figuring out things like, you know, what dose is appropriate for these patients? You know, how long do we give it for? And to be kind of jump through all those hurdles usually takes a number of years before you can kind of get to a true clinical trial in human subjects.
And with respect to human subjects, then would clinical trials deal with people at different stages, you know, stage one, stage four, to test the drugs or the treatment's effectiveness with different people in different stages of cancer affliction and with different types of cancer? Is that part of it?
Yes, definitely. A lot of the new chemotherapeutics or new regimens are actually given in the metastatic setting, so the more advanced patients, and then they kind of, if found effective, start to make their way down to the earlier stages of cancer.
Now, besides getting a physical and getting your blood work drawn, Dan, on an annual basis, are there any screenings we can do for our lungs or for our heart or anything to help be preventative, to be proactive in this, or, you know, for ovarian cancer or uterine cancer?
Yes, for certain types of cancer, we do have some good screening mechanisms. You know, breast cancer, we have mammograms; colon cancers, we have colonoscopies; prostate, we have PSA. Other ones, we have some screening tests. They're not as useful, not as applicable to all patients. So for some either current smokers or former smokers, there's CT scans of the lung, other types of cancers we just haven't developed a good screening test yet. Ovarian being one of those, are kind of trying to work different ways to be able to screen better for ovarian cancer, but there are some, and your doctor could definitely talk with you about the different screening recommendations we currently have.
He is Eric Donnelly. Dr. Eric Donnelly is a radiation oncologist at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Dr. Connelly, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate your insights.
Yeah. Thank you.
It was a pleasure, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one, Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Historic day on Friday. The Boy Scouts of America became Scouts BSA. No more boys. So here's what will happen. The Boy Scouts are going to be all girls, and girls' sports, girls' athletic teams are going to be all boys. That's the new cultural norm. Are you ready for it? Is this fun?
I'm not ready for it because I coach.
Morgan Holmes, 17, filed paperwork to form the first all-girls Scouts BSA troop in Lake Forest.
Yeah, I heard her on the radio. Now she wants to be an Eagle Scout.
Yeah. 8 members so far. Morgan's father's an SVP at Bank of America. Is the Scouts BSA leader, scout leader.
She has an older brother and a younger brother, and they're both Boy Scouts, and she wanted in on the action.
Yeah. When she turned 14, the minimum age to participate in the Explore program for young women, she bought a uniform, signed up. When she found out about the Boy Scouts' decision to include girls, she moved very quickly. I was really happy when I heard that was going to happen. So in December, she officially filed the paperwork to create the first all-girls Scouts BSA troop in Illinois. Hooray! Because obviously there was no organization where 8 girls could get together and enjoy activities together as girls before the Boy Scouts' decision. Was there? Was there an organization?
Yes, there was.
What was it called?
Girl Scouts do compared to Boy Scouts? That's what we need to ask. Like, what do they do differently? Why did she want to be a Boy Scout as opposed to being a Girl Scout? Why wasn't Girl Scouts enough for her?
I heard one father suggest, well, Boy Scouts have more sort of like outdoor activities available.
Well, then join Indian Princesses. Oh, wait, that's not around anymore.
I don't know.
Try to change what they're doing and maybe suggest having campouts and learning how to hunt and fish like the Boy Scouts do. Because, you know, we don't have to stay in the kitchen, ladies. We can get out from there.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. You celebrating Scouts and girls that are Boy Scouts and boys that are female athletes? I just love that juxtaposition, don't you? I'm sure it's coming to a school near you if you haven't already. Oh, by the way, this against the backdrop of that American Psychological Association report on men and the nature of toxic masculinity, which is their synonym for being a man. It's by definition toxic. A good piece in Quillette.com. 12 scholars responding to the APA's guidance of treating men and boys as innately toxic, right? Every man or boy is innately Genghis Khan, and he has to be turned into Pajama Boy. That's essentially the top line. Some very interesting observations from practitioners in the space, including, you know, for example, Chris Ferguson, who's a professor of psychology at Stetson University, talking about the guidelines, fundamental problems. The guidelines lack a broad scientific base, particularly an understanding of biological contributors to gender identity. Tend to use terms such as traditional masculinity, quote-unquote, in ways that lack conceptual integrity and are often stereotyped, tend to read too often as socio-political ideology rather than a balanced and nuanced scientific review. Unfortunately, from my view, the APA has a poor track record of biased and scientifically misleading policy statements, including practice guidelines. Usually such statements exaggerate the consistency, quality, and policy applications of a field of study. The APA statement on violent video games, for example, which is my field, does not resemble the actual science, which has not provided good evidence for links with aggression. Just to give you one example, And there's, you know, a dozen of these doctors in the field that weigh in on the APA's guidelines, politicized as they were. But I know they'll be ignored. And I know most people will surrender. And you'll allow your boys to be pushed out of Boy Scouts and your girls to be pushed out of girls' sports. Because, you know, you don't want to offend anybody in the neighborhood with a hate has no home here sign in their yard, do you? Okay. Hooray, Lake Forest.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Listen to podcasts of Joe Walsh and Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So discussed this piece at azcentral.com last week. This gentleman, Rashad Thomas, who is a U.S. Air Force veteran turned poet and essayist, discussing a holiday party he attended at a restaurant in Phoenix. He sees a photograph on the wall of coal miners at a pub after work, a photograph. The coal miners have blackened faces, you know, because they work in a coal mine. And he sees something very different than some of his friends do, who just see coal miners after work in a pub, and they're
that's what coal miners do after the shift. They'd go to a pub and have a shot and a beer.
And they didn't have time to shower, so their faces are still covered in soot. Yeah. He thought that the photograph should be taken down, and he had a discussion with the manager of the restaurant because he felt that it was consistent with people purposefully putting on blackface to denigrate black people.
And he wrote in his piece that it was a white restaurant owner.
Right. So we wanted to explore this with him a little bit, particularly, I mean, think about this against the backdrop, and this was written before Friday when this all bubbled over, but against the backdrop of the whole Ralph Northam controversy in Virginia. So we're pleased to be joined by, as I said, Rashad Thomas, veteran of the Air Force, poet and essayist. His column, Phoenix Restaurant, says, this is a photo of coal miners, but I see offensive blackface. Mr. Thomas, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Did I characterize the gist of your article fairly?
Yes. I think so. Yes, you did.
So I mean, you suggest in your piece that that based on what you see, the photograph should be taken down, even though you concede it's just coal miners. It's not like Ted Danson or Ralph Northam putting on blackface. And but you're still offended by it, so it should be taken down. Can you just develop that belief a little bit?
Yes. So as an artist, there are four stages that I go through when I'm looking at a painting, a photograph of any sort or medium. So I go through the description, the analysis, interpretation, and judgment. So what I did in this particular case was, as a person of color, look at this photograph, right? And I sit back, I look at it, how does it relate to me? Because we always bring our experiences, we always bring our reality to art. So through my experience, through my reality, I first saw in the photograph, blackface. I looked at the faces first, the smile second, the woman in the corner in her white dress, the clothes, and then the beer mugs. So that's how my mind worked the first time I looked at the photograph. So what I wanted to do, because AZ Central is trying to have a diversity and equity column, bringing out having different community writers write from their perspective. So what I did was write from my own perspective at first glance, because in many cases, when you're in a class or you're having, when you're looking at a photograph with your friends, what's your first response? So that was my first response. So my first response is what I wrote about.
Well, so why should your perspective on it be dispositive of the issue as to whether or not the photograph stays up?
It wasn't. I was using the logic as a person of color first. So from using that logic, I would, at the end, say, oh, this is a black face. This should be taken down. Why? Because it means it's other people. That's my take on it as a person of color and an artist. It wasn't. I never asked the owner to take it down. I actually asked the owner, what did he see? Because he was a white person. So how do you argue this contrast? It's basically a conversation, and I was
but
you see to the you see
view and other people's view, which I think you did say that my friends first said that they saw coal miners. One person saw blackface, another person saw coal miners.
But you did write, I think the photograph should be taken down.
Yes, because using the logic from the beginning as an artist of color, that was my first response. That wasn't my only response. As we've seen, or through the article, there was multiple perspectives. How do we explore multiple perspectives and also come to this discussion about identity, maybe other social constructions like race, class, because I know that a number of folks brought up the point that they were hardworking coal miners.
Right.
And I respect that. My father worked in the coal mine in a cave as a military veteran. And they say that the toxins that were in that cave contributed to his death about 15 years ago. So there is a relationship in the conversation, but again, there's multiple perspectives, and I can't deny my first reaction. I can only share it and then explore how we or whoever is looking at the photograph can relate or have this relationship. How do we have this relationship with this piece?
But do you realize now that these are hardworking coal miners? And some, if you look to the left of the photograph, there's two gentlemen there that probably decided to clean up before going out to the pub, mm-hmm. where others didn't because maybe they just didn't want to. Maybe they just wanted to, you know, get that shot and a beer and hang out with friends.
Yes. So I did the research after. I think most people didn't think I did the research. I just wrote this piece and said, oh, this is how I see it. I think it's taken down. It actually is coal miners after work having a beer, tending the strike of 1912 for better wages. Totally understand the research. There isn't very much, but that was the overall consensus in regards to this photograph. But we also have to consider during that time period, which there is controversy around the parades that they have in the UK around Mummers Day or Darkie Day. Does that have anything to do with the photograph? Those are questions that we're allowed to ask because we don't have, it's just our interpretation. It doesn't mean it, but there's a question. It's not the conclusion. And that's where, in my article, it wasn't my conclusion. It was my first response. That was the logic in the piece that ended up saying, oh, a person of color, like myself, will end up with, I want it taken down because I'm offended.
Well, you write also, you frequently enter art galleries and you're not represented in the art, which leads to uneducated curation for exhibitions. Well, okay, so if I go to an exhibit of Frida Kahlo's work, I'm not represented in the art, so it should be taken down. I mean, you know, you can see whatever you want in a painting or a sculpture, but the issue becomes where you're offended by something I'm not offended by, and for some reason that's not clear to me, your offense takes precedent to my non-offense in terms of whether that art stays posted or not.
You going to a Frida Kahlo exhibit is totally different from me going into a restaurant and seeing a photograph. You and I agree about the coal miners. There's no debate. There's no disagreement.
Uh-huh.
Like I said, as a person of color, as the artist, seeing an art piece, I'm looking through the eyes of an artist. My first response was, this is how my logic ends. This is where it begins, this is how it ends. But that wasn't, again, that wasn't my only observation. The next stage was, I see coal miners, I see the research that I did, and that was it. That was the conclusion. But again, there are multiple perspectives. There's not only one. And I can have a conversation with anyone else and maybe have a different conclusion.
Well, you had mentioned about putting a title card underneath the, a title card with an intention statement underneath the photograph. Do you still think that needs to be placed up in that restaurant?
This is how I look at it. I think we all, what we are offered, what we know we can't unknow. So all the information given to the owner in this particular scenario, it was up to him. I gave three options. I think that many times we complain about something or we're people offended by something, but in the end, we don't provide options, right? So we providing, okay, I may be offended because it looks like blackface. He can choose not to do anything about it. He's the owner of the restaurant. He can also choose, because I offered this idea, because I think education is very important, and I think we instill that in young people that their interpretation of what is not wrong. It is something that they will grow to improve according to any kind of formal education.
Okay,
so that card would be only, okay, this is what the coal miners do. This is what is in this photograph.
It would
not have anything to do with blackface. It would not have anything to do with taking it down. It was just a suggestion with my logic that this would clarify the photograph and even maybe inspire people to even grow and do their own research according to that specific photograph or any other photograph.
Okay, I get the suggestion piece of it, and you see something different than somebody else might see. Okay, fine. But you also talk about your perspective that the photograph should be taken down. You say sacrificing one image for the greater good. The greater good is the standard of whether or not art is allowed, art is exhibited. Are you suggesting this just as a private citizen to private citizen discussion, or are you proposing this as something that should be imposed on a business owner or a gallery owner or an artist? That's, I guess, where I'm trying to understand if you're just having a disagreement about artistic interpretation and the way we should look at art, or you're suggesting that there should be some force brought to bear to make your perspective to hold the day, as it were.
I don't think we should impose our beliefs on anyone. I think whoever's willing to listen, whoever's willing to change their minds, regardless of who they are, their backgrounds, then I think that's where the conversation starts. I think that's where we don't say, oh, we may agree or disagree, but we're able to have this conversation and understand that we're listening and we're also willing to change. So, no, I wasn't saying I wanted to impose my beliefs.
Okay.
I was saying, like I said about the AZ Center, diversity and equity, this is a piece of art, and this is how I see it through my eyes.
So if somebody on a college campus saw that same photograph and had the same perspective you did and went to the administration and says, take this down or we're going to, boycott the school, we're going to protest at the student center, we're going to do something to demand that you take this down. The same way that if a local regulator would come into that Phoenix restaurant and say, you have to take this down because it's offensive to black people, you would oppose that.
No, I think in any of these scenarios, when we talk about blackface or anything that's offensive, we always go to the freedom of speech. And when we honor that, then everybody's able to say and do what, according to their beliefs, when we're talking about these pieces of art, regardless of if it's in college or if it's in a restaurant. I think it's important to say that in college, we should encourage young people to question the world around them. Regardless if the majority agree with them or not, that's how we improve our country, by saying your voice matters.
All right.
If you are going to, don't be afraid to share your voice.
Okay.
Don't deny your voice, and just be strong and make sure you clarify or articulate what it is you want.
I appreciate that perspective. He is Rashad Thomas. He's a veteran of the United States Air Force and now a poet and essayist. Mr. Thomas, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
You too.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.